Well, hello everyone and welcome to the call. This is Lanny Muehlrath, the plant-based fitness expert from LannyMuehlrath.com. And if you are looking for Dr. McDougall's August 1st, 2012 house call, you are in the right place at the right time. And we want to thank you for taking this time to join us and putting such value on your health and your happiness. Because I know that you're going to hear something tonight that will make a difference and quite possibly change your life. It's true. So we have a full house and we have a full agenda of content. So we're going to get started as quickly as possible. So let me explain to you what's going to happen. First, I'm going to explain the simple call and webcast logistics for those of you who are new to the process. And then I'm going to introduce our special guest and then we'll just go. So let me just make sure and see if the good doctor is still on the line. Dr. McDougall, you there?
You bet.
Excellent. Okay, good. Just wanted to make sure. As for logistics, if I ever get dropped for the call for some reason, don't go away. I will call back in. This has never happened with this webcast service, but, you know, you never know. Now, as for asking your questions, thank you, those of you who sent yours in advance. We also have people on the phone lines, all the callers. What happens is if at any point in time there's a question that comes up you'd like to get in the queue, you just press *2 on your phone pad, and that will raise your hand on my air traffic control panel right in front of me. And then as we go through the questions, hopefully I'll be able to get to yours. If you have a webcast question, already we have dozens of questions that have been entered in the webcast screen. So, you know, if you're there, you just type it on in. And then I've got questions that appear that have been written in before. So what I plan on doing is rotating between these three different venues. So I know we're not going to get to everyone's question, but we're going to do our best within the hour. We'll be stopping right at the top of the hour at 6. So we have over 750 registered for this call, so you can imagine the list of questions. So, Dr. McDougall, have you ever had a waiting room that would hold 700 patients?
I'm honored. I mean, you know, even me and Oprah would not probably get as attentive an audience, I'm sure. But thank you very much. Thanks for all your efforts.
Yes. Well, okay, let's go. Here's what I'm going to do. Brief introduction of Dr. McDougall. Not that he needs an introduction yet for people who may not have met him. He has been studying, writing, and I love the way he says, speaking out, not just speaking out about the effects of nutrition on disease for over 36 years. So he believes that people should look and feel great and enjoy optimal health for a lifetime, and who doesn't want that? So he's the founder and medical director of the nationally renowned McDougall program, and maybe some of you have been to the 5-day live-in programs, the 10-day live-in programs, the 3-day advanced study weekends, which we have one right on the calendar. Check it out in September. He's cared for more than 5,000 patients over almost 40 years of medical practice, and his live-in program has been running for at least almost 30 years. So he has developed, in case you didn't know and you don't know about the starch solution, a nourishing, low-fat, starch-based diet that not only promotes dramatic and lasting health benefits and fat loss, but can also reverse serious illness such as heart disease without drugs. And, you know, every year more and more medical research confirms these assertions. It's very edifying. Now, you can catch up with Dr. McDougall's updated works by picking up a copy of The Starch Solution, which is his newest book out this spring. You've got to have a copy. And before we go on a personal note, Dr. McDougall has been a tremendous influence on my own healthy well-being, my weight, as well as my health and fitness business. As a matter of fact, in my book coming out early 2013, Fit Quickies, his influence is all over my nutrition chapter, so you'll get more edification back then. So, Doc, you're all ready.
Yeah.
Any opening comments? Have I missed anything
in
the bio?
I'm glad to be here. I'm glad I'm still, you know, having a good time. I'm the luckiest doctor in the world. You've heard me say that before. I feel that even more as the days go on. I get more people. I have a chance to share the message, which I don't find myself fighting as much as I used to.
Yeah.
The idea that people are supposed to be healthy and the food has something to do with health used to be considered quackery. But it always amazes me. I don't know, I'm sure you, Lonnie, you saw the newsletter I just put out last night. It talks about a Mikhail Hindahedi. I may not have this pronounced right, but Hinde.
Oh, yeah, the World War One.
Yeah, you know, this guy.
Danish starch solution.
Yeah, right. I mean, this guy, he was a medical doctor, a visionary, a nutritionist. He had all this figured out in the late 1800s, and he applied what he knew. I mean, by the late 1800s, he knew that you didn't have to eat fat, that you couldn't reach a protein level too low for human needs. It was impossible to do, to not have enough protein. I mean, he knew that. He'd already raised people. In fact, I gave an example of a guy named Madison in this newsletter that came out last night. You can find it on the website. It's under current newsletters. This guy named Madison that lived for, what did he live for? About a year and a half, maybe 2 years, 23 months he lived on. He lived on potatoes and a little bit of margarine for 23 months. And, excuse me, you see the picture of the guy. I mean, he looks fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
And but see, that kind of experiment was done in the late 1800s. It was done in the early 1900s. It was probably done in the 1700s. I mean, there's a book on vegetarianism that I've read that says to me something that's encouraging and discouraging. One of the things that is encouraging is people have known this for a long time, and so this is truth that's been proved by the fact that it's so enduring. The other thing that's discouraging is that this kind of brilliance comes about and then disappears.
Mm-hmm.
He had this all worked out in the 1920s and 1930s. As a matter of fact, in between 1914 and 1918 in World War One, he basically saved the Danish people from years of starvation and hundreds of thousands of deaths by starvation because he told them to stop eating the animal foods and instead to eat barley and potatoes and bread and so on. And so, you know, obviously 3 million people in Denmark knew that it was not only something you could do to live on all starchy foods, but they also enjoyed it. In fact, I got a letter from somebody today after that newsletter came out, and she said, you know, I love the newsletter you wrote because all the time I was growing up in my Danish home, my family used to talk about Dr. Hindhede and about how, you know, his nutritional principles and how you're supposed to eat vegetables. She said, it just drove me nuts as a child to hear about this guy all the time. My parents always harping about me to eat barley and bread and potatoes and so on. And I thought it was just a joke. I thought they were just trying to be mean. And she said, once I saw your newsletter today, she said, I realized what a brilliant and important man this was and how fortunate I was to be raised in a family that had this kind of nutritional awareness. But it was all forgotten. It was forgotten in the 40s, 50s, 60s. Came about, got a little bit more back into this kind of understanding in the 70s with Nathan Pritikin. I just kind of got my start at that time. Dennis Burkett was getting popular in the 70s, and then it disappeared again. And, of course, a lot of this has to do with money and industry and the, you know, the push to their message. But we're coming back now. We're coming back with a big, big vengeance. Yeah, let's just say it that way. We're coming back with a big vengeance, and we're going to win this time. We're going to win because there's communication like we're doing right now on the telephone with these teleconferences. There's the Internet. There's talk radio, which, by the way, has been bought out by four companies, so it's kind of hard to get talk radio to tell the truth. So, you know, there's an opportunity because people are so aware in this day and age with communication. There's an opportunity to finally get the truth firmly implanted that the human being is a starch eater. If you get involved in these meats and dairies and so on, you're going to get fat like kings and queens. Your family's going to be fat. You're going to be sick. You're going to be poor. I mean, it just makes no sense at all. So I'm excited.
Yeah. Well, it does make you scratch your head when there's so much evidence from people's lives going back so far into the past. And by the way, for those of you who aren't getting the newsletter, you can find it right on the website, and you can go sign up for Dr. McDougall's newsletter. He sends out this amazing volume once a month. It's to me like a book each time. It's full of content just like this that just edifies your practice and helps you feel reinforced. And speaking of books, what's the best way for people to get a hold of Starch Solution? Should they go to your site? Do you
do an
autographed copy if they want it that way?
I would encourage people to just go to Amazon and buy it.
Okay.
That's the easiest way to do it. It's in the bookstores, too. I wrote this book with the intention of changing the world. I'm not going to be modest with you. My intention was to share with you everything I know. I consider my best work and probably my last.
Well, it's an amazing compilation.
Yeah, there may be other things that come out. I've got a few ideas on different books. But honestly, folks, this is my last best effort. If people don't pick it up this time around, we'll have to wait for
Don't let the bus pass by.
Another generation of brilliant scientists that go out there and tell the truth again. It may be another 20, 30 years, if we are around then. anyway.
Oh, well, there's a whole other topic, isn't it? Well, I tell you what, I just love that book because not only for me personally, but it's an excellent reference because I am always connecting people with, since you're the doctor and I'm the coach that connects people with what the doctor says, I can keep referring to, and of course there's online, but having the book to open and flip to and some updated information. And here's another thing. For those of you on the call, I don't know what other McDougall books you've read. I've read them all. And what I do is I have this practice of every year there's a few books that I read again. I always read the China Study. I always read a McDougall book or two. There's a couple of Barnard books that I always read because it just keeps me current with information that's still very viable and keeps growing. But I just picked up, I'm working my way through your 12 Days to Dynamic Health now.
Oh,
I haven't read that in a couple years. Pardon?
That was a very popular book. That hit the, you know, national best-selling list.
Oh, God, yeah, but here's the thing. You're talking about starch-based diet in there, and that's, you know, this is considered an older book. It's initial, but everything, it's so consistent, and it's not that you haven't grown and edified what's going on. It's all being supported by the research, and that keeps adding to your volumes. But you can look back to that book. I mean, you could have written that yesterday. It's amazing.
Yeah,
so anyway, Google, you pick up.
Yeah, I'm thinking about republishing some of the older books. Basically nothing has to be changed. The truth doesn't have to be changed. But we could be discussing the first chapter of Daniel, the Bible, which was written 3,500 years ago, and you'd say, my goodness, McDougall, you plagiarized Daniel's diet. You know, I mean, Daniel talked about in the Bible about taking his men who were sick and eating the rich foods, put them on a 10-day program. Excuse me, I run a 10-day program. Put them on a 10-day program, and 10 days after eating vegetables and water, they were declared healthier than the men who continued to eat the royal food.
That.
I mean, this is nothing. Yeah. This is nothing new.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, we're going to take a first question here. And you know what? Someone has actually raised their hand on my panel. It's so cute. A little hand comes up, and I want to, and this is from Tokyo. We've got to go here. So I'm going to unmute this. And this should be Butera from Tokyo. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah, can you hear
hello
me? Okay.
And welcome.
Thank you.
Were you at the Advanced Study Weekend a couple years ago?
No, I wasn't.
We had somebody from Japan from a couple years ago. It came all the way.
I hope to make it sometime. I just can't do it right now. my question is, I'm basically following a plant strong, no oil, unrefined whole foods diet and starch, as you and Esselten and Ornish prescribe. I actually read the starch solution 2 times already, and I think I'm doing everything correct, including limiting my supplements. I'm trying to keep my total cholesterol level down as I have documented heart disease. I have a bare metal stent in one of my in my RCA, and my total cholesterol has been 133 average over the last 8 months, but the HDL is also low at 28 average. My triglycerides average around 150 to 160, and despite applying this diet religiously for 2 years with 1 hour daily walking exercise, I'm recently showing decreased performance on my treadmill stress test that I just did.
You mean,
and
how do you mean decreased performance? Are you getting ST segment depression?
Yes, ST segment depression. I think
how do you feel?
Three. I have angina on exertion, and when I'm nervous, and when I have to, say, run for the train. But day-to-day normal activities, I don't have angina. And I'm able to do exertion exercise if I warm up, but at first I do feel chest pain.
Okay.
And one of my doctors thinks it's because my triglycerides are high right after meals, and this is caused by carb loading, and there's an after-eating surge of the because of the carb loading, which is not picked up by the usual fasting blood test. My
is
insulin
that, is that what you notice? Do you notice pain after you eat?
No, not pain
okay,
after eating.
Okay, well, that, yeah, I mean, so what he says doesn't fit in with what you clinically notice.
Okay, my insulin resistance score is 29, and my BMI is steady at 21.6, so I'm not overweight at my current carb consumption, and I already limit my fruit juice consumption.
Okay, well, let me see if I can address some of the things, and then you can remind me of the ones you wanted me to address, because you're getting past my point of memory. As far as the total cholesterol and the triglycerides, they're excellent. Anything below 150 on total cholesterol is excellent. When total cholesterol goes down, all fractions must go down, so that's why your HDL or good cholesterol is low. It's supposed to be low. Triglycerides in the 150 to 200 range are fine. You've already cut back on the fruit juice. That's great. All right, so what can you do? What can you do next? Well, first of all, you need to get very confident and comfortable with the fact that this lesion, if you have one that's causing angina, is stable, rock hard, non-lethal. It's not going to cause you any risk of death. Do you understand that?
Mm-hmm.
You do.
It's a heart attack proof type concept.
Well, no. I mean, the blockage that's giving you chest pain is a scar.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's important you understand that because most heart patients I deal with, they're scared to death because they get angina. Somebody showed them an angiogram. You know, they have a history like yours. So they think that these plaques that they show on angiograms are the killers, and they're not. They're hard fiber, stable plaques. Mm-hmm. So let's just assume you have a stable, hard fibrous plaque there that's big enough that it's causing compromise of your blood flow to your heart muscles and giving you angina under a lot of stress. Let's just assume that. Let's just say it's 80, 90% closed. The first thing you need to understand is that this is of no risk to you as far as dying of a heart attack. You also need to look at the pre-heart surgery data when they looked at people who had angina who weren't treated with heart surgery or statins or anything but, say, a little nitroglycerin. The death rate, annual death rate for people with problems your severity or greater is about 2% per year. And these are people that haven't changed their diet. So I think the first thing that you need to get over is the idea that you're a walking time bomb,
mm-hmm.
period. All right, now, second thing you have to deal with is, can you get this angina to get better without surgery? Maybe. I mean, maybe working with your lipids would help, maybe taking a little bit of statin, lowering that cholesterol even lower. That's possible. You could give that a try, taking a little bit of niacin instead, not in addition, and lowering your triglycerides and cholesterol a little bit. Maybe that might open things up a little bit. I'm not giving you a lot of encouragement here, but you're looking for something to help. Next thing is you could take drugs that relieve chest pain, such as beta blockers, nitrates. I don't recommend calcium channel blockers, but you could get something to relieve chest pain, except for the fact that you're not having incapacitating chest pain. You can do everything you want to do. It's only when you put yourself under added stress that you get the pain, so you really don't even need to do that.
I am taking a metoprolol,
okay.
25 milligrams.
All right, so you're on a little beta blocker to help chest pain. Mm-hmm. Now, the last thing to understand is there is a reason to do heart surgery, and that we're talking about another angioplasty with maybe a stent, a bare metal stent. If you're having chest pain that incapacitates your life, like you're terribly worried about it, which I know you are,
mm-hmm.
but to the point you're willing to risk surgery, or say you can't do something, say you want to climb a mountain that you can't climb because of the chest pain, you could take advantage of the symptomatic relieving procedure, which is an angioplasty and or a bare metal stent. So I see that you've got a lot of options up there, but the first thing I think you need to do is get confidence back in your health. You need to realize that what happened with your arteries is history because you don't eat that way anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to cause any more new volatile, hot, pussy sores on your arteries that pop and give you these acute thromboses. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yes. Did you know I have a bare metal stent already?
No, you told me you had a stent. You had one in the RCA. Yeah.
Is it possible that could be the cause of a problem because it's not a natural artery anymore?
It could. I mean, that you could be getting chest pain there. That's possible. Remember, half the stents closed down within a year because of proliferation of the smooth muscle cells.
Yeah,
so
it's been 2 years. But so that should be checked, and if that's the case, can that be opened or?
Well, yes, all that's true. But remember, if you look, you're likely to be treated. So be careful.
Right.
Whether or not you want to look.
I do want to look because it is
right.
Incapacitating for me.
Okay, then do something. But, you know, you could also do an ultra-fast CT scan, a heart scan. The technology for these heart scans is phenomenal these days.
Yeah, I didn't have good luck with that last time.
Okay.
It was inaccurate. But the if I go ahead and do this and they say they want to put a drug-eluting stent inside the bare metal stent because the bare metal stent's not working, or a bypass, what is the best
option?
Well,
you know, those are two things I personally would not do. To me, I mean, I use this analogy in a heart disease talk that I give that you can get. It's on my website. But what I do is I give the example. If I got chest pain walking my dog up the hill in the back of my house, I'd stop walking the dog up the hill because I don't really like walking the dog up the hill that much. But if I got chest pain windsurfing on the Pacific Ocean, hey, that would be incapacitating and chest pain. I would get something done because I love to go out there on my board traveling 34 miles an hour across the water. I love it. So to me, that would be incapacitating. So I would have an angioplasty, if necessary, an angioplasty plus a bare metal stent. But I think I'd give up windsurfing before I went to a drug-eluting stent, and I'm darn sure I wouldn't have bypass surgery. I'd basically sit in a chair and walk to the refrigerator before I'd have bypass surgery. I mean, that's how I feel about it. You've got to make your own judgments.
Yeah.
Wow, what a great complete answer. And, you know, I love the way you said get confidence. You need to get confidence back in your head.
Well, he rightly has been scared to death. Mm-hmm. By his doctors, who were well-intentioned, but they, you know, they misinformed him just like they misinform all patients.
Yeah.
We don't need to go into that, Bonnie.
Well, thank you, Tokyo, for calling in.
Yeah,
very
great
good.
Question, and
thank
I hope
you.
The answer wasn't too disjointed for most people.
Well, I have some follow-up, but I know you got to get on to other questions. Maybe I'll email you.
Yeah, do that. You know I always answer my email.
Thank you.
All right,
thank
good deal.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Yeah, well, you know what? There was just a lot of little information that kind of trickled through that whole Dr. Heart condition conversation that was very valuable for all of us. So thank you for that. Hey, you know, there's another question here that's related to, since he was talking about insulin, or did he bring up the insulin or not? No. Here's
well, he mentioned an insulin index that he has, which I'm not familiar with. I don't
yes.
know. I'd have to look
okay.
that up, but this is some
well, here's a question that I know a lot of people relate to. She says, this is Pam. She says, how is insulin resistance addressed with a starch diet?
Well, that's a very good question because
there
are all kinds of books out there written about insulin resistance and insulin resistance being the cause of lots of problems. One thing that every listener must understand is there's always a little truth in every message. So you need to find the truth, and then what you need to do is put it in an overall perspective, a practical perspective for your health and the world picture. Insulin resistance does occur. It's not a wrong thing for the body to do. The body doesn't do wrong things. It always does the right thing. The way insulin resistance develops is this, is when people eat a lot of food, particularly a lot of fatty foods, what happens is they store some of this fat, and they store it for the day when no food is available. That's called a famine. I know you've not seen one of these, but they used to be really common. So you store up this extra fat, say 20, 30, 40 pounds, getting ready for the fall and winter, for the famine, and that's good. That means you're going to survive. But what happens is in our society where we have so much food and so much rich food and so much sugar and fat, mostly fat, some sugar is a little issue, but mostly fat, is we start storing this fat and the body gets to 30 pounds overweight for the winter and then 40 pounds, and the body says, hey, you know, you're getting to a point, buddy, where if you gain any more weight, then you're not going to survive. You're not going to be able to get away from the saber-toothed tiger or get through that cave entrance. You're just plain and simple going to die by doing all this. So the body tries to protect us. And what it does is it develops insulin resistance. The insulin stops working as efficiently as it should. Insulin drives fat into fat cells.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it's supposed to do, especially when we're storing up for the winter. But you get to the point where the body says, okay, you're killing yourself. So I'm going to make the insulin less efficient. And so various mechanisms take place, and some of these mechanisms have been worked out, where the body's insulin becomes less effective. It's supposed to. That's why the fat people around you, those of you listening right now, look around you. You see those fat people around you? You know, like two-thirds of the people are fat. The body gets to the point where it says, I'm not going to get fat anymore, and so the insulin becomes less efficient because it's supposed to keep us alive and healthy. But if it didn't do that, what would happen is you'd keep gaining weight, and you wouldn't be 40, 30, 60, 80, 40, 20 pounds overweight. You'd be 300 pounds overweight if insulin resistance didn't start working. And I actually see people like that in my practice. I'll see people, men usually, but sometimes women. They'll come in at 500, 600, 700 pounds. And you initially look at these people and you go, oh, that person must have terrible diabetes, high cholesterol, rotten arteries, horrible shape. You check them over and you find nothing wrong. They're just 300, 400 pounds overweight. Why is nothing wrong? Well, what happened with them is their body did not develop insulin resistance. So the insulin just kept pumping the fat into the fat cells. So they didn't stop gaining weight at 60 pounds. Like the usual person would by this protective mechanism, insulin resistance.
Yeah.
Instead, they gain 200, 300, 400, 500 pounds. But it's just because their insulin doesn't work well, and there are things tied to insulin that suggest you damage the eyes and the arteries and so on when those insulin levels get too high and too active. For whatever reasons, and all of them haven't been worked out, some of them have, whatever reasons, is most of us develop insulin resistance as a correct, right thing to do. But the way doctors treat this, instead of getting the person to lose weight, which, by the way, cures 100% of type 2 diabetes, what we do is we just give more insulin to try and overcome the insulin resistance. And what happens to a diabetic? They gain, on average, 20 pounds when they're put on therapies like insulin or sulfonylureas that raise insulin levels.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah,
they get even fatter.
Yeah. Well, then how does the starch diet address the
insulin
resistance?
Well, first of all, you get rid of the fat.
That's
the fat
question.
You eat is the fat you wear. That is why people are getting fat. It's not the sugar. It's the fat. It's plain and simple, the butter, the margarine, the olive oil. That's why you get fat. I'm sorry. I've been doing this for 37 years. It's the fat. And you can prove this. I mean, we haven't gone into the basic stuff, like looking around the world and seeing the fact that all people who live on mm-hmm. starch-based diets are trim with virtually no diabetes. Starch, which, of course, is sugar, it's chains of sugar, starch makes insulin work efficiently. Sugar, even pure white sugar, Brunzell did this study. It was published in 1978 in the New England Journal of Medicine. Brunzell and his buddies up at University of Washington did a study where they took diabetics and they raised their sugar. I'm talking about white sugar, table sugar. They raised their sugar from 45% of the calories to 85% of the calories, and every single aspect of their type 2 diabetes got better. And they declared in this article by Brunzell that sugar, white sugar, table sugar, sugar makes insulin work more efficiently. That's how a starch-based diet helps with insulin. You paralyze the insulin with fat. Fat paralyzes insulin activity. Sugar makes insulin work well. Those are the scientific facts. I know they've been distorted for you, and that's why we have a diabetic rate of about 10%, and they predict it will be about 20 to 30%, because people are still cramming down your throats incorrect information. The science mm-hmm. is clear. The advertisements distort the message.
Yeah, Pam, that was a really good question to ask because it just covered on so many topics. And I think it is true that we tend to, especially because what's so prevalent in the media out there, we tend to still suspect the starches because it's just so pressed that they are the problem in the
media. Well, let's put
an
end to
this. Yeah, the more of us that are just continuing to, you know, call the kettle black on that, the better. And if this happens a lot where people start to be worried about the starches, and I'll go, well, let's look at what was on your plate the last couple of weeks. And interestingly enough, cookies slipped in three times. There were a couple of pastries, and then, oops, you know, all these, well, there it is. There it is.
Well, you need to get over the idea. Any listener who has the idea that starches are fattening, this you have to conquer right away. This is why I called the book The Starch Solution. Mm-hmm. I wanted to take a big, sharp stick and poke it in your eye. I want you to understand what the problem is and what the solution is. It's called the starch solution. And the first thing you think about next time somebody says starches are bad, or you think starches are bad, is you think, well, there are 1.73 billion Asians who live on white rice, and they're all thin, and they don't have type 2 diabetes, and they almost won World War II, and they won the Vietnamese conflict, and they're tougher and stronger and meaner and healthier than any American I've ever seen. And they live on white rice. Or think about the Italians living on pasta. When I went to Italy in 1970, there were no fat Italians. And when I went and ordered my pizza, I felt cheated because they didn't put any cheese on it. You know, I mean, wake up, wake up.
Haven't been
America
yet. You've
got to get over this. Starches, all throughout history, I mean, there have been billions of people who lived on starch-based diet. You cannot show me a single person who lived on a starch-based diet who was overweight. Or let's just say significantly overweight. You can gain 5-10 pounds or so getting ready for the famine, but that's about it.
Yeah. Great. And thanks again, Pam. Here's a question from the webcast. Sherry says, what does Dr. McDougall think about juicing? Juicy topic.
About who?
Juicing.
Oh, juicing. You do not making improve juice. The quality of a fruit or vegetable by beating it 1,000 times with a steel blade. you change the physical properties. Fortunately, the body's tough. The body is really, really strong. I have tested the body. The body will put up with 2 packs of cigarettes a day, a half a bottle of whiskey daily, and it'll live on hot dogs and bacon. I have tested it. So the body tolerates juice. Well, fine. It doesn't make the fruit or vegetable better by grinding it up. Mm-hmm. You're designed to consume it with your teeth and your intestinal tract. Some of the things that happen when you pulverize these fruits and vegetables and grains is it causes the nutrients to be absorbed faster, more completely. As a result, you can measure the insulin rises that are much greater. We just talked about insulin, how insulin drives fat into fat cells. You can see the insulin go up much, much higher.
Yeah.
when you grind an apple or grind a wheat berry,
yes,
into flour. You can see this. This is easy. So, you know, fine, eat a little bit of juice, but it's not the
doesn't improve anything about it. Yeah. Here's a question from that was written in before, and I got a few here on hormones, and
yep.
So I'm just going to read her words. Hi, Lanny. I don't know if it's too late for questions tonight, but of all the plant-based books and info I've read, I really haven't seen anything addressed about hormones, especially in premenopausal women. I've wondered what plant-based foods might help and also how the plant-based community or Dr. McDougall feels about hormone replacement therapy and especially bioidentical hormones.
Good question. I wrote about this in a book called The McDougall Program for Women.
Yeah.
It was published 15, 20 years ago. You can still get it on my website. You can download it under the e-books.
Good.
It's called The McDougall Program for Women. Essentially, every word is up to date, and there's been almost no added knowledge to what's in that book in 20 years. That's the thing. Remember I told you about Hindehede, the Danish doctor?
Yeah, yes,
I mean,
yes.
I have to tell you, I haven't learned anything more than this guy I knew 100 years ago. So the truth is the truth, and it doesn't change. Anyway, you can read the McDougall Program for Women. There are two questions there that I see. How does what you eat affect your hormones? Tremendously. In fact, I wrote an article about 4 months ago, and some of you, I really upset you about this because I wrote about child abuse caused by the rich Western diet, and I talked about sexual child abuse. And I talked about how when feeding the children in this country, the rich Western diet causes child abuse. I mean, a third of them are overweight to obese. But it also causes sexual maturity early. It's called precocious puberty.
Mm-hmm.
In our society, we eat all this rich food, the meat, the oil, the dairy. When we eat all this stuff, what happens is little kids mature early. For example, in studying kids in this country, and this was all published 20 years ago, so it's worse now, but studying kids in this country on the East Coast, what they found is 3% of black girls age 3 were going through puberty.
Wow.
3% at age 3.
Yeah.
That means they were getting breast buds and pubic hair at age 3. Half of the black girls in this country were going through puberty at age 8. The white girls are about a year or two behind. I don't want to go into the reasons, the differences. They have nothing to do with race. They have everything to do with culture. In other words, how people eat. So what's happening is we're taking children who are supposed to get interested in sex when they're 16, 17, 18 years old, when it's time to have babies, and we're causing them to have sexual desires and functions when they're 8, 9, 10 years old. This leads to sexual abuse for a whole bunch of reasons. And so I filed a newsletter 4 months ago, and I filed it to the governor of Florida, Scott, who made a big issue about how it was a huge offense to fail to report child abuse. Now, I happen to be licensed in the state of Florida, a medical doctor I am in the state of Florida, and so therefore I filed an official report with the governor's office about child abuse in this country caused by Kraft Foods, McDonald's, even parents. I mean, you know, where does the guilt stop? And it got a lot of attention. A lot of you liked it. But anyway, it gets back to the hormones. The hormones. If you eat the rich Western diet, you raise your estrogen, your testosterone levels. The little kids mature earlier. You go through your menarche. In other words, you start your first period earlier in life, like 5 years, 7 years, 8 years earlier than you should. And then you menopause later in life. You go through menopause at, say, 52, 53, 54, instead of 48, 47, 49 years of age like you're supposed to. So you menstruate longer. Women who menstruate longer in life and end up with more disease, that's because both are caused by the bad food. So if you change your diet, what happens is your menstrual periods, they decrease in amount. They become shorter together as far as the days between periods. You bleed, say, every 24, 25 days instead of 28 days. Periods become lighter, less painful, et cetera. You go through menopause earlier, that's all cool. All right. Now, that's, you can change your hormone levels a lot by what you eat, and of course exercise and weight, the amount of weight you carry around are two other important factors. When it comes to HRT, this is all discussed in the McDougal Program for Women. I made these recommendations 20 years ago. I still prescribe using that book that I wrote. So I prescribe hormone replacement therapy to women. Why do I do this? Why do I prescribe hormone replacement therapy to women? Because I like to make women happy. It's been a lifelong dream of mine. I'm sorry, folks. That's just the way it is. I like to make my patients happy, too. That's been a lifelong professional dream. And the result of prescribing HRT to women is I make my patients happy. The women like it. I sit down and I explain to them there are risks, but there are benefits, just like any drug therapy.
Well, here's another related question, and you probably address this in the book too, but what about periods of time? Like if she says, you know, I've gone through menopause and I started hormone replacement therapy, but now it's been 10 years, and I'm wondering if there's a problem with continuing forward.
Well, you should only take HRT to treat symptoms. So if the symptoms aren't there anymore, then stop the HRT. It's not a normal thing, natural thing to do. I don't think it's the right thing to do. You know, the ideal thing to do is to go through menopause at age 48 and just enjoy a healthy life post-menopause or post-reproductive life. There's a time to stop having babies. You know, women are supposed to stop having babies when they're 50 because they need to live another 20 years to raise them. That's what nature designed, you know. So, if you have any question about your needs of HRT, stop them. I'll tell you why I prescribe it. I prescribe it just for a few reasons. I prescribe it to make women feel better, not to prevent heart disease. It does not. Not to keep the bones healthy, which it does. It does keep the bones stronger, but there are better ways to do that. Not to keep the women looking younger, which it probably does a little bit. I prescribe it for women because they don't feel good at the time of menopause. Some don't. They have hot flashes. They have feelings of loss of femininity, not feeling good overall in general. And they also have problems with sexual function. Not all of them, but a few of them do. And that's because after menopause, our designer, I think, decided that once you can't have babies, there's no reason to have sex. Now, he never consulted me. Or she never consulted me, or whatever. You know, I mean, so you stop. What happens is the estrogens drop, the vaginal tissues become very friable. They become dry, sometimes, not always, and thin.
Yeah, yeah.
And as a result, it's more difficult to continue on an active sexual life for some women, not all. And as a result, I can give them HRT, and I can bring about some of that youth. Not all of it, some of it. And improve what they perceive as quality of life. But I want to caution, you can overdo this HRT when it comes to vaginal issues. I see this all the time. You know, a little is good, but a lot can cause overgrowth of the vaginal tissues. So I often have to caution women, you know, you just use a little bit, you know, once a week, a couple times a week, you know, a few days before a planned date, you know, you just use a little bit. And you get big responses, and then don't use any more than that, just a little bit.
Yeah, well, Sharon, I want to thank you for adding to that question. And the first question, too, and I think the best thing is to go ahead and get Dr. McDougall's book, Program for Women, because that would probably answer a lot of questions that I'm sure have arisen as in response to hearing the initial answer to the question. So excellent. And how great that is. So you haven't had to do any editing on recent editions of that, it stands from what you did? Wow.
Yes. If I was going to update it, my guess is I would add about a page each chapter of things that have happened in the last 20 years, and it would not all be good news. Otherwise, the basic stuff is all there. There's nothing different. I counsel women all the time about who have breast cancer, menopausal issues, and so on, and I just refer them to the chapters, and of course, I've written updated things on this, but nothing, as I say, nothing changes. The truth doesn't change.
Yeah, nothing counters what you've got in there. Good question. It's
almost frightening, Lonnie, to think about how little things have changed. My son just became an internist, an internal medicine specialist. He's about to take his boards next week, and so he'll be a board-certified internist just like myself. And we discuss medicine, and it just shocks me that the therapies he gives today are basically the ones I learned as a student 40 years ago. Nothing's changed.
And he still doesn't get nutrition in his studies.
No nutritional education, no. Yeah, he's kind of a rare bird out there. But it's changing. It has really changed, especially where he is. He's up in Portland with Oregon Health.
Yeah, there's kind of an awareness up there.
That's a pretty cool community
bit.
And a really great school, and they're much more progressive than most schools. And I have to tell you, you know this, and some of your listeners do, that we're doing a study. In fact, we're just finishing it on the dietary treatment of multiple sclerosis.
Yes, please, we're doing it with their neurology department. Yes.
But I just want to share this with you, and I know none of your listeners will tell on me, but I just want to share some of the responses that I hear from the neurology department, from the doctors there. They're overwhelmed. They have never, ever seen people get well before. I got a letter yesterday, not important who it was from, but let's just say it was somebody really important in the neurology department. And he told me, he says, we should be going out on the road bragging about what just walked out of my office. She said, this man was in the program, in our Diet MS program. He was educated down here in Santa Rosa by our team. He says to me, and this was within the last year, he says to me, I have never seen this before. This is a guy with multiple sclerosis. This guy has lost 60 pounds. His balance has tremendously improved. He says he just walked up Mount McKinley with his two sons, something he could have never done before. He says to me, I have never seen this before. Well, yeah, that's what happens when you give a bunch of stupid, expensive, useless, harmful drugs to people and you don't fix the darn problem. Why would you expect to see anything? Anyway,
well,
they're so
the results
excited
of this
up there at the
be
university
published
with our work.
Yes, go ahead.
That's it. They're excited.
Oh, well, when
we're
are
excited.
We going to be
the
able to...
Changes.
Is there? It is. And is it... I hope that gave people... A lot of people asked that. They wanted an update on that. And just hearing one person's reflection like that is... tremendous.
Well, let me just tell you one other bit of news, which, you know, again, you're going to keep it quiet because you're not supposed to share results of publications before
they're
published.
Oh, we're all sworn to secrecy.
Yeah, we're sworn to secrecy. Let me just tell you something else that they got shocked by is they looked at the compliance data of the patients. Now, remember, we took the intervention group
and we educated
him here down in Santa Rosa, and the control group, they kept eating the Western diet. So we've been done very, very careful food frequency questionnaires. And what they found is that the people initially, control and intervention, were on a 40% fat diet, typical American diet, 40% fat. And then we intervened with our program here in Santa Rosa, and their fat intake dropped to 15% or less. They maintained that 15% fat diet for a year. Nobody has ever seen this before, Lonnie. Nobody has ever seen these kind of results. And that's a result of the clarity of the diet that we teach and the effectiveness of our instructors. Besides, it works. And when people like this man I just told you about, I think I know who he is, he's a school teacher, he couldn't play with his kids because he was so sick and so overweight with multiple sclerosis, and now the neurologist can't believe what he sees, and he's so upset.
He got his life back.
This doctor is proud to be a doctor, probably for the first time in a long time. It's horrible being a doctor who passes out drugs and surgeries that don't work. You know, you either have to lie to yourself, which we have to do, to keep going, or you have to find another way. I happen to find another way of over 40 years ago.
Well,
not 39 years ago. It was 1973.
Yeah. I know that there is compilation of the research material to be done now until it gets to a point that we can read the results. So
yeah, it'll be over the next year. They'll be looking at this is a blinded, randomized, single-blinded, randomized control trial, highest quality you could possibly do. And I only had a limited amount of money. I spent, I had $750,000 to spend, which is, you know, nothing when it comes to a drug study.
I know.
You don't get started with that kind of money. But that's all I had. So I had to use the limited resources to get the biggest bang for the buck. And we will be analyzing the MRIs done with contrast and the blinded neurology examinations we did for this disability. We'll be evaluating those over the next 6 to 12 months. And reporting the data, there's every reason to believe it's going to be as good as I expect, and my expectations are huge. And you compare that, if you got today's newsletter, to the results of multiple sclerosis drugs. I wrote about the MS drugs. JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, published an article about 3 weeks ago looking at the long-term effects of multiple sclerosis drugs on MS patients, and they could see absolutely no benefit. And these are drugs that cost $36,000 a year just for the medication. And
per
these
person.
People and their doctors go into taking this garbage, criminal garbage. I mean, this is horrible to do this to patients. They give this stuff out believing it's going to work, and the evidence says it doesn't, and this conclusive evidence from JAMA should put them out of business, but it won't, because money speaks loudly, and people continue to be hurt, and their bank accounts drained. I guarantee you, if doctors told the truth to patients about the drugs and the surgeries that they're offering, the truth, very few would accept the treatments, and if the patients had to pay for it themselves, the heart surgeries, the diabetic pills for type 2 diabetes, the multiple sclerosis drugs, the arthritis drugs, if the patient had to pay for it out of their own pocket rather than the insurance company, nobody would buy them. Nobody would buy them. This is one of the biggest criminal acts that's ever taken place in human history. When the historical accounts are written about medical practice in the 20th century and now the 21st century, people are going to look back at this and they're going to say, you know, putting leeches on people was humane. To the things we do to people, destroying their families, their bank accounts, their lives, destroying them as we have, is just unforgivable. Am I being clear?
Well, I wanted to ask if it's still, do donations to the McDougall Foundation still assist with this process?
Because we'll go on to a second phase, but we're still taking donations. But, you know, Lonnie, my guess is when the results come out, people will be throwing money at us. Right now, I have to beg for money. But, you know, once they see what we're doing, I think, you know, the movie stars, I mean, who has multiple sclerosis that we know about right now? Mrs. Romney.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, not that I wish.
Well, would you do another a study that would just be a narrower band of what you previously did?
No, we do the exact same study. We just have more people in it. One of the things that they told me from the beginning is that, you know, that, John, you just don't have a lot of money, and everybody's going to have to do well. They're all going to have to follow the diet, and the results that you predict are going to have to occur for us to show the benefits. And so I threw the money on the table, and I said, you know what? Our crew is good enough to make these people change their diet effectively, and I just told you we did. You know, compliance was huge. So we passed the greatest obstacle of doing the studies to get people to comply. Now what I have to do is hope that my faith in the effectiveness of the diet on neurologic lesions for multiple sclerosis is as good as I think. And my mentor, Dr. Roy Swank, believed for 50 years. He was the head of neurology at Oregon Health and Science University for 50 years, Dr. Roy Swank. He told me many times, this was an honest man, he says, John, he says, it stops the disease. I said, Dr. Swank, I always called him Dr. Swank, not Roy. I said, Dr. Swank, I said, how often does it fail? Well, one time he told me, well, 1 in 200, I think. And another time he told me, well, I think it's 1 in 500. In other words, it almost never fails. So I took him on his word, plus with my experience, and I expected not only people to comply, which they did, but for it to work, which we'll find out in the next 6 to 12 months.
Yeah. You know, speaking of Dr. Swank, I have a client up here that I work with some exercise, and she was a Dr. Swank patient, and she met him long before. She's involved. I coach in the CHIP program up here, and I met her through that. And so she knew Dr. Swank before you, before any of these other people, and she's just always so excited, and I always think of you.
Yeah, I know. I meet some of those patients, too. They do well, don't they?
Yeah, she is amazing, and she's in her 70s, late 70s, and she's just a real beauty because of what she's done with her diet and her life.
Let me tell you, half the patients treated with the best drugs available at $36,000 a year just for the drug, half the patients are unable to walk unassisted, wheelchair-bound, bedridden, or dead in 10 years with the best therapy available. Your client, Lonnie, I mean, is probably doing everything she wants to do. As all the clients that I have seen at Dr. Swank's who followed his program, they're all doing well.
Yeah. This is like other people that I have known with MS through my life. The ones that are on the meds, there doesn't seem to be any change over time. But I could not believe that this woman, she's, you know, lifting weights and doing stretches and just doing, it's normal. Normal life.
She got a life. When they write the history books, they're going to be called criminals, the way they treat people.
Well said, boy. Okay, perfect. Thank you for answering the MS question, because there were several people who just really wanted to hear from you about that. Okay, Karen asked a question here on the webcast. What is your opinion of dentists using fluoride treatments on adults? Actually, that brings up the whole fluoride thing.
Yeah, well, you're getting out of my field, you know, dentists.
Okay.
I think good news. I'll give you some casuals on my just personal stuff. Don't take this as professional advice. You know, I'm pretty darn sure that what we eat causes dental problems. I think every dentist is. And if you eat a healthy diet and feed your kids a healthy diet, they're going to be tooth decay free. There's even good evidence that that crooked teeth are due to problems in utero when a mother eats improperly. I think this is going to really upset you, but hey, it's a personal thing I'm telling you. I think flossing is a big hassle and a waste of time. I'll tell you what I found that really works well, and I personally use this, and it's made a huge difference in my dental hygiene, is intradental brushes. I mean, think about it. When you're, say you're a caveman, you're walking along. I mean, how often do you find dental floss hanging from a bush? But how often do you find something to stick between your teeth?
Right. So what's describe an intradental brush for
everybody. They're like little bottle brushes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, little tiny brushes. Yeah. You stick
I think my dentist has those.
Yeah, to take the food out of your teeth as opposed to flossing, or maybe in addition to flossing. Those are the things that I've found help me personally. But, again, I'm not a dentist, so
you know, can you go sit at the drugstore? You can get those little intradental
brushes. Yeah, you get
the
little brushes.
They're really tiny. Brushes. Yeah, they're like tiny bottle brushes.
They're tiny bottle brushes, and they work so phenomenal. You floss, and then you take one of these intradental brushes, and you clean after that, and you'll see how lousy the flossing is. It's an amazing
Okay, we're all going to be carrying those around now.
Again, think about the last time you were out for a walk. What'd you find when you were walking along? Little pieces of plant
stuff
that you grabbed off the bush
and
you stuck between your teeth naturally and cleaned them out? Excuse me, I think this is a pretty natural, normal way to clean teeth. It's been going on for millions of years.
Yeah,
flossing,
good idea. Yeah. Okay, there's a good tip, you guys. You know, bottle brushes.
You never expected that, did you? I wrote about that once many years ago.
Oh, about the brushes? Or
yeah,
about
I wrote about them several years ago in one of the newsletters.
Okay, well, you just keep throwing rocks through windows. We're counting on it.
You know, Lonnie, I tell you, you catch me now, and, you know, I'm excited about this this Danish experiment with 3 million people. You caught me last month, and I'd have been over the top over the paleo liars. You know, and next month you catch me, who knows what I'll be on. 2 or 3 months ago it was mammography. There are just so many exciting issues that I get involved in, and I'm a very lucky man that I have so many things I'm interested in when it comes to medicine. But they all come down to the same thing, and that's conservative medical care and good health based on diet. That's basically what I want to know. I want you to know that I'm interested in, and those are the things I'm an expert in. I want to tell you what the dietary approach is. I can tell you what you should do with the diet I recommend in two sentences. The McDougall diet is a diet based on starches with fruits and vegetables. There's one sentence. And it contains no oil or animal foods. There's two sentences. There you go. There's the whole diet.
Yeah. And then we make it so complex.
It's so simple. But the thing is maybe simplicity keeps people from doing it. They can say, well, how could it be so effective? I can guarantee, in fact, I probably am talking to the choir here, but I can guarantee that, you know, there's not a doctor who wouldn't just be knocked over seeing his or her patients go through this type of therapy and say, you know, that's why I became a doctor. That's what I wanted to help people do. And we were given all these horrible tools.
Well, that's in your story, too.
Pardon?
Yeah, that's in your story. That's in your story where you say you were just realized you really weren't helping people, and you just you could not stand the lack of integrity of just keep giving pills and people weren't getting better.
Well,
you made
I couldn't
that change.
Stand the lack of professional fulfillment. I hated being a doctor. My patients never got well. I was the lousiest doctor in the world. Well, actually, I was just like the rest of the doctors that were pushing the drugs and the surgeries for these chronic conditions. But I didn't realize that. I took it personal. I thought I was the terrible doctor. Every doctor out there wants to help patients. I'm sure of it. I have no doubt.
Yeah.
That's where the reward comes from. And so the reason I do what I do is not because of you. It's because of me. I want to feel good about myself as a physician. So when I administer therapies that work and you come back to me and say, oh, guess what happened to me? You know, people come up to me all the time at lectures. They say, well, you're probably tired of hearing about this. And I go, no, I'm not. Tell me.
No, I'm not tired
at all. I
want to
hear it one more time. It feels so good. Yeah. Tell me again how I helped you. I can't tell you how lucky I am to have this very simple message that works. And you know, these days, more and more people are seeing that it is practical and they can do it and their life is worth it. And, you know, their kids shouldn't be fat and sick. And they've just decided, you know, this isn't really crazy stuff. Of course, this crazy stuff was very popular 100 years ago, and probably 200 years ago, and back in the time of Daniel. And you know, it's just that we lost our way. You know, after we got involved in these world wars and post world wars and all this money and economics, and we just lost our way.
Well, I love the way you put the dietary plan into two simple sentences, and I have to tell you that one of the most popular things that I ever write about is when I just kind of describe what I ate for a day, and people see not only that, yes, that's what I eat, and they're also so excited to see that how much I ate.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when they start telling me that, well, I had a half a potato for, and I go, no, three potatoes. And
yeah. You know, yes, I mean, you've got to eat. That's why you're hungry, is you're supposed to eat. That's one of the things that I talk to people a lot these days. I say, look, we all have to agree on certain things. One is we all have to eat. People go, yeah, we have to eat. And the reason we eat is to get energy. We're trying to get energy, not protein, not vitamins, not minerals.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to get calories, energy. Okay, so we've agreed on two things. Now we have to get to the choice part. When it comes to your sources of energy, you can get energy from protein, fat, or carbohydrate. Protein and fat are dairy and meat. That's what we're talking about. Carbohydrate is plants. So what it comes down to on your dinner plate is you can get energy from dairy and meat, or you can get energy from plants, or, you know, refined foods we could get into. But, you know, basically those are the unrefined foods that you can get energy from. So you can get dirty energy, which is meat and dairy, and be fat and sick and destroy the planet, or you can get clean energy, which is from plants. Now, you have to pick plants that have lots of energy. You can't pick broccoli and kale and cauliflower and sprouts because you'll starve to death. You have to pick starches like all large populations of people have picked throughout all of verifiable human history. They've lived on starch-based diets. So you find some starches you like in your case, potatoes or sweet potatoes or barley or corn or rice or pasta or bread or whatever. You know, you pick it. Mix it up. It doesn't matter. And then all of a sudden what happens is, hey, I feel good. The bowels are working. Oh, my blood pressure's down. I get all my blood pressure pills. Chest pain's gone away. Whew! You just go, wow, I didn't know I had so much in me. Well, it's there. Just unleash it. Just stop that towel from dropping all over your arteries.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Very inspiring, too, the way you put that together. I like making it simple like that. And I think we have time for one more comment or question here. And this has to do with, since we've been talking about weight and putting it on and taking it off, this person says, Shauna says, I very much want to know how lipolysis happens at the cellular level, under what conditions and why, in other words, how your body burns its fat.
Yeah, well, you know, that has to do with lipase enzymes and all kinds of things that I have probably forgotten about from my biochemical education, which I'm sure she can look up on the Internet. But I would put it in these simple terms. Is that it's inefficient for the body to carry around the extra fat. It only does it under circumstances of duress, only in an environment where it has no choice, where it's surrounded by fat and sugar, does it have to resort to accumulating this excess mass that it now has to carry around. Once you alleviate that burden and you give the body an opportunity, it heals. It wants to be healthy. The body heals. It always does. It's always trying to get well. It's always trying to be most fit, most agile, best able to survive. It's one of those innate things inside of us, this energy that, you know, nobody tries to describe. It's like, you know, it's like the rules of survival. It's like, you know, why do you take a breath? It's like, why do you fall in love? I mean, you know, all these, there's just certain things that happen with people, and one of them is to, is a person wants to live, an organism wants to survive, and it's going to put itself in the most advantageous situation so it doesn't die. It's just one of those innate life things.
Survival.
And being fat doesn't meet that criteria. So if you stop burdening the body with this, all this rich food, it naturally attains its best position to survive.
Nice. Great point to close on. Perfect.
Okay.
Hey, you know what? I just made a dent in question, so are we going to be able to talk you into coming to business again?
Hey, this was a great hour for me. Anytime
okay.
I don't have to get on an airplane, it's a great hour for me.
Yeah, good. Excellent. Well, Doctor, if you could just stay on the line for a minute after I close up the call so I can connect with you real briefly before closing out
Thank
for the
you
night.
Thank you, folks,
but
for listening. It was fun for me. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. And I want to thank again everyone for being on the call, for taking the time out to be here live. It shows a real commitment. I know some people couldn't, and I'll be sending out the recording afterwards so you can listen to this over and over again. And thank you so much, Dr. McDougall. It's been an inspiring hour, educational hour, and a heck of a lot of fun. So on that note, good night, everybody.